This is VOA News coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. With the coronavirus pandemic finding new strength here in the U.S., two of America's largest and most populous states have reimposed some restrictions. This after the daily number of confirmed infections in the country surged to an all-time high of 45,300 yesterday, up almost 5,000 from the day before. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has ordered all bars closed, while in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis put a stop to serving alcohol. They joined a small but growing number of states either retreating or pausing any further reopening of their economies because of worrisome virus outbreaks. Health experts say large numbers of cases are being seen among young people who all too often show disregard for the use of recommended face coverings and social distancing. Abbott had put in place one of the most aggressive reopening schedules in the U.S. Now, other than shuttering bars, he has scaled back restaurant capacity and says outdoor gatherings of more than 100 people would need approval from local officials. In Florida, the agency that regulates bars acted after the daily number of new confirmed cases neared 9,000, almost doubling the record set just 2 days earlier in the state. Florida's Miami-Dade County announced beaches will be closed over the 4th of July weekend. It's citing the growing number of infections among young adults. Louisiana reported its second one-day spike of more than 1,300 cases this week. Governor John Bel Edwards has suspended further easing of restrictions. California Governor Gavin Newsom is asking officials in Imperial County near San Diego to reinstitute a stay-at-home order. The state now trails only New York in case counts, with about 207,000 infections and nearly 6,000 deaths. The White House Coronavirus Task Force held its first briefing in nearly 2 months Friday, and Vice President Mike Pence gave assurances the U.S. is in a much better place than it was 2 months ago, and that the U.S. had flattened the curve of virus cases. In fact, it is difficult to reconcile his words with the dramatic infection spikes in so many states. Via remote, this is VOA News. The current pandemic numbers in the United States, close to 2.5 million cases and 125,000 lives lost. The global figures, 9.8 million cases and close to 495,000 deaths. The numbers compiled by Johns Hopkins University. German Chancellor Angela Merkel today cautioned that the coronavirus pandemic is far from over. This as regional outbreaks raise fears of a second wave of COVID-19 illnesses in Europe. Germany has been fighting recent spikes and this week put a western section of the country with a population of 500,000 people under lockdown. Germany has lost nearly 9,000 lives to the virus with 194,000 cases. The newest infections were traced to a slaughterhouse. European Union nations are finalizing a list of countries whose residents will be allowed to travel to the member states as soon as next week. Currently missing from the list because of their COVID virus numbers, the United States, Brazil, and Russia. India has reported another 18,000 COVID infections, pushing its case count to nearly 509,000, with fatalities nearing 16,000. The city of Guwahati, the capital of Assam state, will be locked down for 2 weeks beginning tomorrow, with nighttime curfews and weekend lockdowns in the rest of the state. India has recorded the fourth highest number of cases in the world behind the U.S., Brazil, and Russia. Despite rising virus numbers, Egypt today is lifting or easing many of its pandemic restrictions. After 3 months of lockdown, cafes, clubs, gyms, and theaters are being allowed to reopen, all with capacity controls. The same for mosques and churches. Egypt's COVID numbers close to 63,000 cases and 2,600 fatalities, the highest totals in the region. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund has approved an $8.2 billion loan for Cairo. That's on top of $2.8 billion IMF dollars already pledged. Australia is bracing for more imported virus cases. About 300 people were due to arrive this weekend from Mumbai, India, with others expected to follow from South America and Indonesia. There are estimates that 5 to 10% of the returnees are infected. President Trump canceled a planned weekend visit to his golf resort in New Jersey and says he's staying in Washington, in his words, to make sure law and order is enforced. Mr. Trump has suggested the use of force on protesters who try to take down historical American monuments. He signed an executive order that threatens to withhold federal support to state and local enforcement agencies that fail to protect monuments. More news online at voanews.com. You can also get the latest on the pandemic any hour, day or night. There is also a convenient, easy-to-listen-to mobile app. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
I believe the current appointee, Mr. Dara Jallo, ticks the boxes, and we have expectation that he will discharge his duty in accordance with the Constitution and will take off from where his predecessor Abubakar Tambari left.
The Gambian President Adama Barrow appoints a new justice minister.
A hope and an idea that Uganda goes beyond President Museveni, so that when we get into this negotiation, we would like the actors that we will align with to keep in perspective the fact that Uganda will outlive President Museveni.
The founder of a major Ugandan opposition party seeks to become its presidential candidate for next year's general election.
Then some Christians started to realize that actually to take precaution and to create social distance, staying at home and complying with the lockdown was something that is necessary.
And Zimbabwean churches call for a national solution to address the country's poor healthcare system. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A new Malawian president is scheduled to be installed at a ceremony in the capital Lilongwe Sunday. Results released by the Electoral Commission show main opposition leader Dr. Lazarus Chakwera from the opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, won the presidential poll rerun. His bid in the election rerun was backed by the incumbent vice president, Dr. Saulos Chilima, of the opposition United Transformation Movement, UTM. The two opposition parties joined forces, which was called the Tonse Alliance, in the run-up to the poll. Chakwera's win makes Chilima, his running mate, the only person in the country's history to be elected vice president for the second time. Vincent Kondwe, a Malawi governance expert, says the wind of change was too strong for the ruling party to withstand. He tells me the outcome of the election is indisputable, maintaining that without the presence of international poll observers, the Electoral Commission was able to administer free, fair, transparent, and a credible election.
It's a moment of freedom. You know, the general atmosphere is so ecstatic. People are very happy, celebrating. There is an element of gaining some freedom. I don't know for whatever reasons, but the atmosphere is like people are feeling much more liberated and that they can exercise their rights. But the general atmosphere, to be very, very honest, is so ecstatic and moving forward. We hope this is how, as citizens, Malawians will have to live their lives with the incoming new government.
Vincent, there are concerns that there could be a last-minute hitch which could prevent the swearing-in of the new president in parliament on Sunday because the ruling party or the outgoing ruling party is challenging the outcome of the result.
According to our laws governing elections management, they will have to go to the court and petition the court if there are any irregularities. But that does not stop the Electoral Commission from announcing the winner. So legally, it has no consequence on the swearing-in ceremony of the incoming president once the Electoral Commission announces the result.
Now, Vincent, as a governance expert, I'm looking at the stance of the outgoing or the ruling DPP party. What do you think are their prospects if they approach the court seeking redress because they claim or they said that the credibility of this election or poll rerun was undermined by violence and rigging?
Well, in any event where elections are being conducted, you can't rule out irregularities. You can't rule out violence because the tempers are quite high. But the question that we need to answer is, to what extent were the irregularities or to what extent was the violence affecting the quality of the elections? To be very, very honest, I think, and to be very, very fair, This was one of the best organized elections. The level of security was quite high and tight. We saw the Malawi police servicemen and the Malawi Defense Forces servicemen anywhere else. So the extent and magnitude of the violence was not on that larger scale where one can say that they compromise the outcome of the elections or that they compromise the will of the people. So my take is that, yes, there are some reported cases of violence, but largely they did not affect the way the elections were conducted. So largely I would say that the elections were very free, fair, and very credible, such that the outcome of these elections is a true reflection of the will of the people, as the framers of our constitution had envisaged.
Talking about security, before the elections last year, opposition groups were expressing concern that the police were biased in favor of the ruling party as against them. What changed that now all groups, including the opposition, are commending what the police or the security service did in terms of ensuring people went to the polls without intimidation and reducing cases of or incidents of violence or harassment during this presidential poll rerun?
What has changed is the level of cautiousness and active citizenship that the people of Malawi have demonstrated. And I think there is a level of cautiousness that the wind of change was blowing across the country, and the anticipation was that there would be a change of government. So I think the message was very clear across the nation, such that the security agencies were aware that they have to conform to the requirements of the law in the performance of their duties, that they have to protect everyone, regardless of whether they're supporting the opposition political parties or the ruling party. They have to protect and secure the life of everyone, regardless of where they're coming from. So the most significant part of it has been the wind of change has been blowing at the country, especially as we're moving to the polling day, such that it was very clear that anyone who, even maybe a security officer, who was maybe trying to be to be partisan, I think the people could have dealt with such kind of element. And I must also highlight that the Malawi Defense Forces, the army, were very professional and independent. And as we have seen during the time of the demonstrations from 2019 up to 2020, whenever the police officers were trying to be partisan, we saw the army intervening and coming in to act very professionally and stop the police from being partisan. So, well, that is the kind of the context in which these elections have been conducted, to the large extent that security was quite high, and one would comfortably say that everyone was very free to exercise their right to vote.
Vincent Kondwe is a Malawi governance expert. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Dauda Jallow is the newly appointed Gambian Justice Minister. President Adama Barrow nominated Attorney Jallow to replace the outgoing Abubakar Tambadu, who resigned a few days ago and is expected to leave office on June 30. Jallow is expected to officially start his new job on July 1. Tambadu, a popular official in the Gambian government, launched an investigation into gross human rights abuses allegedly carried out under former Gambian President Yahya Jammeh. Gambian human rights defenders and activists say Tambadu's departure will leave a big hole to fill. Saliu Tau, president of the Gambian Law Association, says the sudden resignation of the justice minister is a surprise. He, however, tells me that newly appointed Dauda Jallow is a good choice to fill the position the former justice minister is leaving behind.
Frankly, I was really taken aback and surprised when I heard of the resignation of Abubakar Tambadu as justice minister. I mean, obviously, the rumor started hovering in town for the last week, and finally it was officially confirmed. Yes, it was a surprise to me personally, and I'm sure to a lot of the bar members.
Some Gambians are saying he did a fine job and that his departure will leave a big hole, although it's obvious that the position will be filled. What is your reaction to this?
My reaction is that, Tambadu did a fine job. He's leaving behind a fine legacy as our first post-transition Attorney General. He came at a very critical time in our country's history. Our country was at a crossroad, and he was able to initiate a constitutional review and building process that was inclusive and participatory amongst many of the reforms. And yes, it will be, he has left big shoes to fill, but I believe a replacement has already been found in the person of David Jalo, who's also a competent and sound and level-headed legal practitioner. So I believe there'll be continuity. I believe that the foundation stone has already been laid by his predecessor. And I have confidence that Dauda also will take on the mantle from where Ba left it.
Some Gambians are saying that he was compassionate with the victims of Yahya Jammeh's rule, and that his departure could weaken the institution seeking justice for the victims of Yahya Jammeh. What are your views?
Yes, the former Attorney General was very close to the victims of the former regime and was very passionate and showed a lot of empathy for their pain. And surely his departure will be felt. But I believe the institutions are already in place and the motion is set to ensure that the victims of the former regime, particularly victims of the former president, will get justice for the loss and the pain they suffered under the rule of the former president.
So what qualities do you anticipate or want to see in the next Chief Justice or Attorney General of the Gambia?
In my humble opinion, Peter, an Attorney General must have professional competence, meaning you must be well-versed in the laws of the country and the Constitution in particular. You must be professionally independent, given that you're an advisor to government and must at all times give the government professional advice that is right, without fear or favor. You must be a person of integrity and a person who is principled.
Peter, I believe the current appointee, Mr. Dauda Jallow, ticks the boxes, and we have expectation that he will discharge his duty in accordance with the Constitution and will take off from where his predecessor Abubakar Tambay left.
Saliu Tal is the president of the Gambia Law Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. The Zimbabwean Christian Council, or ZCC, is calling for a national solution to address the country's poor healthcare system. The church group says the system is not prepared to deal with the coronavirus. Local media reports confusion over the disease. They say some deny the existence of the disease, while others say the coronavirus is a spiritual ailment. Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mtata, General Secretary of the Zimbabwean Christian Council, says Zimbabwean churches are helping to address the impact of the disease. Apart from educating people about the disease, Mtata says, the churches have also been providing food to help those in the informal sector who have been unable to cope with the government-imposed restrictions and the economic and social impact of the disease. Reverend Mtata tells me that calls by the church group for a national comprehensive solution to address the issues exposed by the coronavirus is the best way forward.
Yes, I think the challenges that are facing Zimbabwe that have been exposed by coronavirus range from the existing challenges that the nation has been facing for the last 40 years. For example, the fact that we have not managed to have a cohesive national society saw the COVID-19 increasing the conflict that we see, for example, at the level of the political parties not being able to work together to find a common solution to the problems we are facing. The second level is that we have already had a failing health system, and the coronavirus has just exposed the weaknesses in our health system, and we can see right now doctors and nurses are on strike because they are afraid that they do not have adequate equipment to deal with the COVID-19, making many, many citizens vulnerable, not only to the COVID-19, but also to the other illnesses that they have to suffer in the context of this winter. So we have challenges that have to do with corruption. We have seen that COVID has led to the availability of financial resources And we have seen the heightened and exposing of high levels of corruption that we have not seen in this country for a very long time.
Let me ask you this, Reverend Tata. So far, with these challenges that you've enumerated, how are the churches or church groups or religious groups in Zimbabwe responding to some of these challenges as a result of the coronavirus?
Of course, the first task the church has carried out was to correct the myths around COVID, because also there has been a misunderstanding within the faith community of what COVID is all about, because sometimes people spiritualize the COVID as a problem. But what we have been trying to do is to demystify the COVID-19. But on the level of the economic challenges, the church has been engaging with the state and speaking out against the corruption that we are facing. But they're also intervening by sprucing up the health institutions that are run by the churches so that the churches could take care of the emergent situation that we find ourselves in. The churches have also been providing food, especially in the communities that are heavily affected, because many people are in the informal sector. So by COVID-19 and people being locked down, many people could not take care of themselves. And the churches have been intervening by providing the humanitarian response. But what we need to deal with, Peter, is the real situation of national political paralysis. And this is what the church is calling for right now, is calling for a comprehensive national settlement that should come from a broad national dialogue to resolve all these issues. These issues cannot be addressed piecemeal. They have to be addressed together. And that's why the church is calling for a comprehensive national solution to these issues.
What has been the responses of church members, as well as the society in general, about the efforts being done by these churches to demystify some of these myths, spiritualizing it, as some of these religious groups have been putting across?
When the COVID-19 started, you know that especially churches that are led by some of the popular prophets and apostles started to go out making different kinds of prophecy when this COVID was going to come to an end, what it meant, and so forth. And of course, it at first it was very difficult to convince people that they needed to take medical precautions, because some churches wanted to insist that people must be gathering, and because they believed that they could get healing, instant healing, even in the midst of COVID. So initially there were some signs of resistance that people could continue worshiping, but after some time of showing how the dangers of coming together could affect congregants, then some people started to take this seriously. We also had to engage with churches like in Italy, where there were people, Christians, who were affected by COVID. And then some Christians started to realize that actually to take precaution and to create social distance, staying at home, and complying with the lockdown was something that is necessary.
Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mtata is the General Secretary of the Zimbabwean Christian Council, or ZCC. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. Meanwhile, the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association is calling for a new law which bans torture in the southern African country. Dikamai Berry, National Director for the group, says it will continue to use litigation as one of the measures to combat torture. His comments come as the Human Rights Association joins other human rights defenders to mark the International Day in Support to Victims of Torture Friday. The theme of the day was "The World Stopped, Torture Didn't." This year marks 33 years since the United Nations implemented the Convention Against Torture in 1997. Dikamai Berry, National Director for the Human Rights Association, tells me that it appears torture is on the rise in Zimbabwe despite the ongoing global coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the state of affairs today, as we commemorate this day, is that this is happening in the midst of the fight against COVID-19. And within the cover of COVID-19, torture has increased here in Zimbabwe. and we are working to show solidarity in various ways with victims. So our association, which is the Zimbabwe Human Rights Association, is a member of a coalition of Zimbabwean NGOs called Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum. So today, to mark that day, we held a round table which brought together a number of human rights NGOs to reflect on the journey that we have worked in Zimbabwe in trying to fight to eradicate torture, the progress that we've made, and the outstanding task.
So what are the basic fundamental challenges that human rights defenders in Zimbabwe face currently?
Fundamental challenges currently are that we are under COVID-19-induced lockdown, which has restricted freedom of assembly and association. Within that space, the government of Zimbabwe has moved to amend the constitution through the constitutional amendment bill number 2. And they are dragging this bill while we are under lockdown so as to limit as much public participation as possible. So civil society organizations like ours, which is fighting to defend the constitution, is having to work within these restrictive measures because we can't mobilize our members to attend the public hearings and to contribute to this conversation. So these are the main challenges that we are facing in Zimbabwe currently.
As you are aware, officials usually deny there's perpetrated torture or government undertakes torture of civilians or unarmed civilians. When issues of such incidents arise, what do your groups do, especially your group? What do you do when the government sharply denies the issues of torture?
That is exactly the reality. You probably know that there were 3 women who were tortured, who were young leaders of the opposition movement for democratic change. And the government denied that they had been tortured. So what we did was to provide evidence that they had been tortured, medical evidence, and to petition the Ministry of Home Affairs to carry out the investigation. However, the Ministry of Home Affairs has come out to say that the victims are lying, that they were tortured, and they've gone on to arrest the victims, and they are now charging them with seeking abduction. Within the current restrictive measures, there is very limited scope of what we can do besides the advocacy that we are doing, writing petitions and approaching the United Nations and hoping that the UN anti-torture mandate voices are going to be needed in this case.
So let me ask you, for victims of torture, what recourse do they have? Do they have protection under the Constitution to seek redress for, you know, the torture meted out to them?
Now, currently, our law, which is the Constitution, and some aspects of our criminal law are consistent with the Convention Against Torture. Section 53 of our Constitution prohibits torture. The freedom from torture is an absolute right. So victims of organized crime or victims of torture can approach the court and sue the perpetrators for compensation where they have been tortured. And there are many organizations like ourselves that work with these victims to help them to approach the court and seek justice and compensation. You probably know of the popular case of the abduction and torture of Justina Mukoko, which was also brought before the court, and Justina was awarded $150,000 as compensation for torture. By the time the money was paid, it had been eroded by inflation, but it is significant in the sense that it's a public record that the state has tortured her, and they continue to use torture in the institution. So that's what victims can do. But they are gaps because if a person commits torture, there is no an anti-torture law which creates the crime of torture. So if a person commits torture, they are charged either with assault or something else. And usually the sentencing does not reflect the gravity of torture, which is why on a day like today, we are asking the government to ratify the Convention Against Torture and pass an anti-torture law, which acknowledges that torture is a crime as it is and provides for rehabilitation of victims and punishment.
Jikamai Bere is the National Director for the Human Rights Association. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Alice Alasu, a leading member of the Ugandan opposition party, the Alliance for National Transformation, or ANT, has been nominated as the interim national coordinator of the group. This after General Mugisha Muntu, national coordinator of the party, stepped down to seek to become the presidential candidate for the ANT for next year's general election. Until her nomination, Ms. Alasu was the deputy national coordinator for the opposition party. According to the party's constitution, she is supposed to serve in the new role for 1 month. Analysts predict Muntu will become the party's presidential candidate due to his influence. They, however, say the lack of a united opposition front will enable incumbent President Yoweri Museveni to win. Alasu tells me that Mr. Muntu will be unable to lead the party if he wins or loses in his quest to become the presidential candidate for the ANT.
Yeah, it is true. General Mugisha Muntu has stepped down, taken leave of his office so that he can conduct this contest as a presidential flag bearer to become a presidential candidate in the next election. The party right now is in the process of receiving expression of interest, and next week there will be nomination. Thereafter, the party will conduct a national delegates conference to elect its flag bearer, who will then contest in the general election. Now, this resignation is based on two issues. One, the philosophy of the party. We are building a party which we would like to act as an institution. First of all, the infrastructure of the party should be or able to operate irrespective of who is at the helm. So our key philosophy is institutional building. Secondly, we then understand that it is improper, and this is the culture we want to impart into our country and Uganda particularly. It is improper for somebody, an office bearer, who has an interest in an activity to be the one to superintend over it.
Are you therefore saying that this has been the culture in political parties in Uganda, and that is why you want to change it?
Yeah, I mean, in Uganda, you can have a flag bearer who is also a presidential candidate and also presiding over an executive decisions in the same matter to ensure that President Museveni has an edge over the rest of the candidates. So you can imagine election calendar, which gives the rest of the candidates 1 month, and then President Museveni has been traversing the whole country because he has been president, and then he's going to use an helicopter or a plane funded by the state to run to places, all these many districts that the government has created, at the disadvantage of fellow contestants in the race. So our thinking as the Alliance for National Transformation is to start a culture where leaders do not misuse, do not abuse their offices to the disadvantage of the others. That is one. Two, to build an institution which gives comfort to the nation that even when we are in responsibility, when we take over the state, we will not misuse taxpayers' money for a political contest where we are interested in.
Now, what, as a deputy national coordinator of the ANT, where does this position leave you? Do you take up the mantle as the coordinator, so you wear two hats in order to lead the party structure to organize the presidential contestants who are vying to lead your party in next year's presidential election?
Yes, so the constitution provides for all that. The stepping aside of General Muntu is a constitutional requirement. I needed to add that and then come to a point where that before he steps down, he actually signed the responsibility to one of his deputies, who is me, to superintend in the office of the national coordinator. The delegates conference is slated for 6th August. And in the delegates conference, we will then be able to unveil a new national coordinator for the party. So I am just in an acting capacity to steer the party until the substantive national coordinator is unveiled on the 6th of August during the delegates conference. Then that substantive coordinator will also steer the pattern. And I think the next delegates conference where the national chairperson will be elected.
So let me ask you this, Ms. Alasso. A lot of Ugandans are saying that despite the ruling party not being popular, a plethora of opposition political parties are not helping the situation to wrestle power, since all of you have one big object to get rid politically of the ruling party. Why not form an alliance to brighten your prospect of election victory in next year's presidential vote?
Partly that analysis is correct, partly it's, I don't think, very plausible. Why? Because to form an alliance, you must have developed capacity so that it is an alliance that is formidable. If I woke up now as the leader of the ANT and just join an alliance and behind me there is no structure, there are no leaders, there is no ideology, there is no philosophy, it will be an alliance that is hanging in the air. So we at the Alliance for National Transformation are committed to building a coalition, but we would like to have a coalition which is strong, a coalition that is backed up by party structures, by party values, by a hope and an idea that Uganda goes beyond President Museveni, so that when we get into this negotiation, we would like the actors that we will ally with to keep in perspective the fact that Uganda will outlive President Museveni.
Alice Alasso is a leading member of the Ugandan opposition party, the Alliance for National Transformation, or ANT. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In the Kenyan capital, Nairobi's Kibera neighborhood, those who depend on day-to-day wages have been hit hardest by the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. While the Kenyan government is providing some support, a local charity has formed to pick up the slack. The Adopt a Family campaign connects well-off Kenyan families with those less fortunate. So far, the initiative has connected more than 400 families, providing relief to many in desperate need. For VOA, Ryle Ombo reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
3 months ago, 43-year-old Annette Okumu, a mother of six, was running a cake-making business on a busy street in Nairobi, and her husband had regular work as a painter. Then, Kenya's Minister of Health announced the country's first coronavirus case. Less than a week later, no one was buying cakes from Okumu, and her husband stopped getting jobs. Okumu's child, born with sickle cell anemia, started to get sick after several days of not taking medication.
At this time, there's no food, there's no breakfast, no lunch, no supper. For 2 days, I wondered, what next? Am I going to lose my kid? So when I saw Adopt a Family, it was late at night through social media. That is when I decided, enough is enough. Let me speak out.
Annette called the number on the Adopt a Family Facebook page. Moses Omondi picked up the late night call and asked Annette to meet him the next day. Omondi says he started Adopt a Family after the Kenyan government issued a stay-at-home order in March.
It led to many of the employees, you know, closing shop in order to adhere to the directives. In the process, there are people who are relying from hand to mouth, these two manual laborers and staff. Most of them lost their jobs. I sat and thought, what can I do that can adhere to the government directives? That's when I thought, why don't I look for families who can support a family?
On the night that Annette Okumu made the call to Omondi, Joe Bitange, a video editor in Nairobi, was online reading about the Adopt a Family initiative. Bitange reached out to Omondi the following morning and was connected with Annette Okumu. Soon, Okumu's family had their first meal in 2 days.
I decided to support one family by giving them a voucher. And he told me that the voucher that I gave him was actually supposed to support a family, to feed the family for 1 week. Yeah, so come the second week, I also gave him another voucher. And very many people now came in because they knew I was part of the program, because I was among the first people who joined his team.
In less than 3 months, the initiative has connected 460 families from the slum to another 460 families who give them financial support. In early March, following a stampede in Kibera that killed 2 people, the government said it would pilot a cash transfer program to help the most vulnerable members of society buy food during the COVID-19 pandemic. Many Kibera residents say they have not received that cash, however. Government representatives in Kibera say they are doing their best to help the needy during this time and that personal initiatives such as Omondi's are important in filling gaps. Nehemiah Amocha is the assistant chief of Gatwekera location in Kibera.
And the government also came up with the vulnerable persons in the community who get some support from the government itself, the aged, the orphans, the widows and the others, the bedridden. So far, the government has done very well. But you see, as you cannot do it alone, you need partners. And this is why we say the likes of Omondi are the best in the world.
Apart from direct money transfers, Adopt-A-Family conducts food distribution drives for needy families. They also run a feeding program for children in the slum, where Annette now volunteers her time cooking. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Cameroon says the temporary closure of most restaurants and border trade during the COVID-19 pandemic has dropped food prices by up to 70%. While food sellers are suffering their lost income, cheaper prices have helped some of Cameroon's poorest to cope during the economic disruption. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
After the COVID-19 pandemic forced restaurants to close in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, a new way of business emerged to sell the surplus of cheap food. Trucks that used to deliver large quantities of food to the city's eateries and hotels now go from street to street, selling fruit, vegetables, and chicken to the general public. But food distributors like Christopher Nanze say the pandemic is destroying their business. He says his wholesale buyers have dried up with restaurant closure and the banning of large gatherings and border trade. Nanze says they are suffering because vegetable, meat and chicken sellers no longer have access to markets in Nigeria, Gabon and Equatorial Guinea since the neighboring countries sealed their borders to stop the spread of COVID-19. He says food prices have decreased sharply. Nanze says the price of a 20-liter bucket of fresh tomatoes has dropped from $15 to only $4, while the price of a chicken that weighs 1.5 to 2 kilograms has fallen from $10 to about $3 to $4. But in poor neighborhoods where day laborers and laid-off workers have been struggling during the pandemic, the cheap food is a blessing. Among the buyers is 39-year-old unemployed single mother of 2, Amina Awa. She says it is the first time in her life that she can afford to buy a few meals of meat per week for her children. She says she is very happy that food is now very cheap and poor Cameroonians like her can add chicken to their diet. Awa says she does not like seeing people infected and dying from COVID-19, but she wishes for prices to remain low so that the poor can also eat well. But as the poor like Awa express joy, Cameroon's farmers' trade unions have called on the government to assist them. The Cameroon Poultry Trade Union's Joseph Chum says the fall in food prices means members are unable to repay their loans. He says farmers are also discouraged from producing, and if no government assistance comes soon, Cameroon may face a food shortage.
La crise sanitaire actuelle est un appel divin à repenser nos économies.
Chum says the COVID-19 crisis has exposed Cameroon's fragile economy. If the government does not give financial assistance to farmers and food sellers, he says their businesses will crumble. Chum says banks that gave out loans to traders should renegotiate the terms because so many people cannot afford to pay them back. Cameroon's Minister of Finance, Louis Paul Motazi, says the government is preparing a rescue plan for farmers. He says the government plans to give farmers tax breaks and subsidies to ensure production.
Pour bien comprendre l'effort que je dis gigantesque du chef de l'État.
Motase says the government and Cameroon's president Paul Biya are very much aware of the difficulties that traders are going through. He says they are doing everything possible to assist them. Although the government is already losing close to $2 billion in revenue due to COVID-19, says Motase, Biya has removed taxes for foodstuffs. Motase says the government has vowed not to allow the possibility of any food shortages. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Go sinuezi Nikipofu na papasa juu yako na hisi ya kuna amani sikuona nyumbani moyo unajawa tafarani kwichi kwichi chumbani aziishi kichwani hasa pale ukiwa mbali na mimi tuchea kuni kwa kishindo jiko lako ni mimi unipe joto joto bezi kwenye baridi tangangana nawe nitabaki nawe sitokuacha mpweke shika shike leo usiniache mimi chunga siniteke hani mi kwako nazimbata nitafune unavyotaka kiuno sindi machakacha terebuka unavyotaka Chombeza umeniweza nipendoa Tuchangie na damu Milo kinchombeza ukinigusa minaloa Sinachewa ubani Lindini Kesho nitafune milimi Na bao la ushindi Mcheza jichake kigimbi Roho zina wama Nitafune unavyotaka kiuno sindi machaka
you know I love you. You know I love you.
Do me, my love, and I'll retire, baby. Oh, baby, I'm gonna try. Me and you.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you close your eyes because of the bad people around you, you will not see the good people passing you by. I'm your host, Peter Clotain, Washington.